if we understand that the Earth now is kind of the continents are all moved into a certain position, but at some point they were one large landmass called Pangaea.
Right.
And you know
that. And that does make sense because if you try it, the Earth, you know, the continents, they fit together.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sumerians give a very interesting tale of explaining that our primitive Earth, billions of years ago, they say before it had finished becoming a solid mass, it had this interaction with what they called Nibiru. It was a kind of like a rogue star that somehow got attracted to our solar system, and there was this collision between our primitive Earth and one of the moons of this star or this planet that came into our solar system. And this huge...
All right. What you're referring to is Planet X, right?
I am.
Okay. And you're saying that it was not Planet X that collided with or even disturbed us by being close, but it was one of the moons of Planet X that collided with Earth.
That's correct. Yes. Yes. And so
okay.
The Sumerians don't use the term Planet X. They use the term Nibiru. And
right.
We again see similarities in this cosmological story from the Sumerians where when this collision took place, we had half of our Earth get strewn out into what we now call the asteroid belt. Mm-hmm. The Bible calls it the hammered out bracelet. and then the Earth that we know of goes into its current position in its new orbit. Now, after a large calamity like that, where half the planet is strewed out into the asteroid belt, if you think about it, that leaves us with just half a planet, literally a Pangaea. But mm-hmm. over time, we've now moved into the positions like the skin of an apple. The continents have moved to where they are. So there's little pieces like that, Art, where the Sumerian version of many of the stories of our creation or of our cosmology, our science is kind of catching up and going, huh, the Sumerians actually knew information that our sciences are just now starting to confirm.
So what you're suggesting, there's two ways to look at this. One is the biblical, and the other is something even older that you've been talking about. And you're suggesting that they do coincide, but at some point, you're going to have to sort of make a intellectual mental choice about, well, the Bible. This was one way to explain it, but...
Mm-hmm.
Over here, we have this other thing that happened, and it's the real thing that happened.
Right, and so that's why there's this wonderful context from all the other cultures around the world, not just our one Judeo-Christian view or the Mesopotamian view that's now extracted into our Christian view. There are all these other collaborating cultures that have a similar line of evidence in that the knowledge that they had, it seems to be so complex that when we look at most of these ancient cultures like the Egyptians, Mayans, and Sumer, they were right out of the Stone Age, right at the time when it seems to have been that they were, just starting. They're at the most advanced part of their civilization. And then they kind of gradually went downhill. So it's a hard thing for us to try and figure out, like, why are these gaps in knowledge? It seems like many of the ancient cultures knew a bunch of information and ways to build monuments that we can't today, and then we kind of forgot it all when we went into the Dark Ages.
Right. I want to talk a little more about Planet X, so hold tight. We're going to take a break here. We actually have to do that about twice an hour, and we'll certainly dive right back into this. What do you think so far, folks? Could it be? I mean, after all, we are here. Are you willing to look at alternate possibilities with regard to how we arrived? I'm Art Bell.
One of 4, a truly prime number in the Sirius XM universe. For intelligent dark matter conversation, dial When the Spirit Moves, 855-REAL-UFO. That's 855-732-5836.
Don't let the spirit move just yet. We'll let you know when it's time to dial. We're speaking with Jason Martell, and we're talking about the past. I mean the severe past. There's something I want to interject here, which is probably a non sequitur, but I can't help myself. We're talking about the pyramid and...
The Prime Directive disallows dark matter contact with emerging AM world life forms. However, as an extraterrestrial client, you are cleared to call 855-REAL-UFO. That's 855-732-5836.
Jason Martell is my guest, and we're talking about things ancient. Jason, welcome back.
Thank you, Art.
You were talking about Earth spinning on its axis. And, you know, for a second, let's go back and talk about Planet X. That is sure. A subject that really has a lot of people going. I get emails and communication all the time from people saying, Planet X is coming, it's coming, it's coming. You can see it on a clear day or a clear night. People are sure that it's just about here or will be here shortly. And I've always kind of gone, I don't know. It seems like the astronomers would be letting us know if Planet X was headed our way. But that doesn't mean it isn't. And that doesn't mean that a rogue planet couldn't be out there, because it could. So what's your best guess about Planet X?
Well, I think in this last hour, I'm going to try and hit it home for you, because I know a lot of people are interested in Nibiru, Planet X, especially what they hear online. And in this last hour, I'm going to kind of talk about the new model, which I think explains why there would be a Planet X, or it helps put into the context of a Planet X existence. But
excuse me, Jason, do you mean you're only going to be on for another hour? Because we have 2 hours of show to go.
Wow, that's great. Then
oh,
my
you didn't
bad.
Know that, huh?
I didn't know that.
can you stick around?
I think I can, yes.
Okay, all right. Planet X.
So basically, you know, the Planet X topic is one that's very interesting, because up till now, everyone has been assuming that it's just one sun, that, you know, our solar system is comprised of one sun, and Planet X is on this huge elliptical orbit based on the ancient information, and so it very rarely comes by our inner solar system. However, that might not actually be the complete model. Based on most of the latest science that we're getting from our telescopes in space, most solar systems, external solar systems, not ours, most solar systems are binary. They have at least two suns, some in an intricate dance up to six or more suns in this, you know, unbelievable orbit. But there's strong evidence to suggest we are a binary solar system, so that we actually have two suns. Our second sun would either be a brown dwarf at this point, or is something that we haven't been able to identify. Like, for instance, let's call it maybe Sirius could be our second sun, and, you know, it's somehow in this intricate dance with us, which is kind of where I'm going to lead into this spinning on the axis before we picked up after the break. So I realize the Planet X topic is very sensitive to a lot of listeners, and hopefully in the next couple hours we can really start to boil down some of the science that I've been latching onto and finding very intriguing, which further change the variables of a Planet X model.
There are a number of people I've spoken to recently who believe there is another sun, and that it is hidden and we can't see it because it's behind our current sun in some way.
Well, Art, there are over 30 cultures that were aware of this large cycle of time and specifically talk about two suns. Even the Sumerians have a very interesting tablet view of what appears to be like the Tower of Babel, and they're ascending it, and there's two suns at the top. But many cultures were aware of the idea of us having two suns, a lot of them coming out of the ancient Vedic texts in India and such. But where this
All right,
really...
that issue aside for a second of the second sun, although we'll come back to it, but Planet X, would you regard Planet X as essentially a rogue planet that visits on a very long orbital time, like 25,000 years, something like that?
Right. Well, I think the orbital pattern that is talked about in some of these ancient Sumerian texts is they give it a 3,600-year orbit around our sun.
Oh.
We look at the Sumerian evidence and see that they had a very advanced math system based on two numbers, 6 and 10. So the Sumerians had mathematical constructs and diagrams that showed how they were able to divide into very small numbers and very large numbers. Some of these numbers ticked up into the billions. So one of the numbers that they used was 360. They were the first ones to designate 360 degrees to a circle. Now, if you just take a string and attach it to a stick, put the stick into the dirt and outstretch that string and then walk around, you create a circle. But they were the first ones to actually designate 360 degrees, and they called it a shar, which meant a complete circle. So they gave the reference of Nibiru, this planet X, as having a shar of 3,600 years, which meant a complete orbit.
So let's see, 3,600 years. So it would come and visit every 3,600 years, presumably at roughly the same distance from the Earth?
Yes, and I did a little mathematical calculation a while ago, and around 2003, when this was, a little bit more hyped on people listening to things on the internet or looking at webcam photos that possibly show a lens flare interpreted as a second sun, I did some math that showed, if our solar system's been around our Earth, more importantly, for, let's say, 4.7 billion years, and Nibiru's orbit is 3,600 years, or every 3,600 years it's potentially coming by Earth or the inner part of the solar system. If we divide 4.7 billion years by 3,600, we get well over a million times Nibiru has completed an orbit through the inner part of the solar system. So it's probably likely that not every time there's an orbit, that it affects us. We could be on the complete other side of the sun when Nibiru comes into the inner part of the solar system. It might have minimal effects on us.
Well, it would change something. I mean, it would be close to something in the solar system, and so there'd be some great change every time, I would think.
And
perhaps not in Earth, but some great change.
Right. And, I know that people can point to things, the planets heating up in various spots, Jupiter spot and various things. Can't explain, what Nibiru's impact would be on us, but looking at the evidence, if we look at the spacing between the planets, just between Mars and Jupiter is where the asteroid belt is.
Right.
Now, right between Mars and Jupiter, there's plenty of room for a large planetoid object to be passing through. And there's actually even gaps in the asteroid belt that could be considered planet-sized gaps, as if something had passed through it.
Mm-hmm.
And Art, I always jokingly made the reference that, we're talking about the 12th planet from the Sumerians' perspective. They called it the 12th planet, as well as Nibiru or Planet X. But if we just think of it as the 12th planet passing between Mars and Jupiter, I used to make the joke that it's like MJ-12, Mars, Jupiter, 12th planet. But it's probably nothing. Nibiru has been coming through our solar system for millions of, at least over a million times, and I know the current hype today is that people are interested when they hear the historical evidence of how this interaction in the past caused a great flood and how the ancients are tracking this planet. But I agree with you in that I remember Hale Bopp very clearly. Mm-hmm. And I actually, as I mentioned, lived in San Diego, and my parents lived in Rancho Santa Fe, and something happened a few blocks over from my house.
Yes.
The amateur community of astronomers has been very astute at always pointing out things like Shoemaker-Levy 9 or Hale-Bopp well before the professional community, and then it gets escalated to the actual science That's level. Mm-hmm. So if there is a Planet X, we're talking something 4 to 8 times the size of Earth going on the Sumerian descriptions. this is a large object. Anything anywhere near the inner part of the solar system, there's a pretty good likelihood that the amateur astronomers would pick that up well on its way here.
And if it made a fairly close pass, the impact on Earth?
Well, you know, in the past, as I mentioned, the Sumerians give a very elongated tail that explain how in the past, when Nibiru passed by, it actually caused gravitational pull on our ice sheets, our tectonic ice sheets up at the top. And just like a ice cube being dropped into a glass of water, one of our ice sheets at the top of the Earth just kind of cracked off into the ocean and instantly raised the water 300 feet or more. So, you know, that's kind of a little disconcerting to think about, you know, that it has had this effect in the past. But Art, really where I focused my attention with the whole idea of Planet X and Nibiru isn't on the, you know, the catastrophe potential. It's more on the potential of reuniting with ancestors that are off-planet. I mean, if Nibiru does exist, it's very possible that we actually have ancestors that live on that planet.
That's Yes, it's pretty heavy. I don't know that we'd be happy to see them again.
Or would they be happy to see us and what we've become?
Jason, if you do the math, and I know that you're doing the math, when might we expect, let's assume it's absolutely true for a moment, Planet X, when would we expect a close pass again?
Well, you know, Zachariah Sitchin had a specific date that's, you know, a few hundred years from now. It's really something that's going to be difficult to pinpoint until our telescopes and science can actually confirm where this planet is. Now, since the early 80s, Zachariah Sitchin met with the lead astronomer for the Naval Observatory, Dr. Robert Harrington, and compared the Nibiru model with the Naval Observatory model, which concluded Dr. Robert Harrington had a model that showed by just including one extrasolar planet, it explains all the anomalies we see in our current solar system, why Uranus is tilted on its side, why Pluto and Neptune could be possibly dislodged moons of Saturn, various things that we see. At the time when he was doing his calculations, again in the 80s, Dr. Harrington said all of the planets are suffering from something called perturbations. All of the planets are being pulled in a certain direction within space, but there's nothing there. There should be a large planet, but there's nothing there.
Well, it's kind of like thinking of a pool table with all the balls on the table scattered around, and then taking the cue ball and slamming it into the middle and see what happens. And
yes.
only actually, it's worse than that because of the gravitational effects. You don't even have to hit anything; you just have to get close, right?
It's kind of whiz by it, right? And so, you know, there's been this model being calculated for quite a while now that shows, you know, there's probably something out there that's affected our orbit of the planets in the past. And now as we look into this extrasolar Planet X, is there another large body within our system? What do? We go ahead and demote Pluto to not being a planet. I don't agree with that. But, you know, it is an interesting thought that we are now using extremely advanced telescopes. We have one out there now called the Spitzer Telescope. Actually, I think it was originally called CERDIF, and they renamed it to Spitzer. So either one of those names would bring it up, CERDIF or Spitzer, if you Google it. This telescope is amazing. It's sitting out in space, and it's able to temperature regulate itself, where it sits at a temperature just below freezing. And other telescopes that we have out there, like Hubble and the IRAS, most of these other telescopes are not able to penetrate these large dust clouds. When we start to look really deep into space, there are certain areas where there's these, you know, dark, cloudy masses, and we can't see through them. However, these new telescopes, like the Spitzer, are completely infrared. So they're able to calibrate themselves to the temperature of this dust cloud and just penetrate right through it using infrared, essentially a heat signature. So we're starting to get detail and see all these new suns and different solar systems. And there is a large likelihood, Art, that we will actually identify a rogue planet that fits the Nibiru model within the next 10 years that's actually viewable and trackable within our solar system. At that point, then it becomes a little more interesting to go, well, you're saying that there's this planet 48 times the size of Earth and we're tracking its orbit and it's going to come into the inner part of the solar system or be near us in 200 years? Interesting. We should keep an eye on it.
Keep an eye on it. Jason, that would be an ELE event, probably. If it got close, an LE. It's definitely an LE. I mean, I don't know if it would be another great flood or if a hunk of the planet would break off or we'd assume a new orbit that ended up changing the temperature on Earth by about 100 degrees. Something awful like that is definitely possible.
It is a possibility, but, you know, there's really nothing that anyone can do at that level. If there's going to be an LE event, like Deep Impact, what am I going to do to worry about it or even, you know, research something like that? If it's going to happen, it's going to happen. Where I find it interesting, Art, is the fact that, you know, there seems to be another angle to just the catastrophe side of possibility.
All right, but stick with that for just a moment, and then we'll move on. Jason, if your research led to the fact that Nibiru actually was coming, Planet X was or is coming, and in a couple of hundred years will produce an LE-like event here, would it be your position that the people of the world should be told, or that the people of the world really should go on about their business, and telling them would only produce the ELE event probably ahead of time anyway, because everybody'd panic and go nuts?
Yeah, that's a hard one to answer. I think my personal opinion is I do think that the world has a right to know, and I do think that the powers that be financially, I don't mean the government, private equity, would take our race off planet. I know XPRIZE, Bronson, Bigelow, there are many people that are looking into, you know, taking us into space. So I think in a couple hundred years, we're probably going to advance very quickly in that realm. But really, who knows? And Art, this really will go back to the topic of this lost cycle of time, in that there seems to be, again, which we're going to get into, a reason why we go into the Dark Ages, forget everything, and then go into this Golden Age and have this enlightenment. But it's very possible that, you know, there's another factor outside of just the cycle, which is catastrophic events. In the last time we were in the Golden Age, I calculate that there was also a cataclysmic event, meaning we're super advanced technologically and spiritually, and here comes a huge asteroid or something that, you know, wipes us all out and really makes us lose touch with this lost information. That could happen again.
Well, Jason, maybe it's sort of a cosmic race. In other words, this planet comes by every however many years it is, and it's a race to see if we have become technologically advanced enough to do something about it and get humans elsewhere to continue the human race, as it were. And maybe we just haven't quite made, you know, won the race just yet. But we're advancing very quickly now. We're going very quickly now. So you never know. We might make it this time.
Well, you know, ever since, you know, some of these, like, presidents, like Reagan, you know, giving his speech in front of the UN, you know, about, you know, isn't there already an extraterrestrial presence? I think it's really interesting that, you know, within our lifetime, hopefully some of this knowledge will become more prevalent, and there does seem to be some type of desensitizing. And I almost think, Art, that, you know, it seems like Earth is the one on quarantine. If we look at, you know, the idea of like a galactic federation, Star Wars,
yes,
Star Trek, some conglomerate races
yes,
collaborating, you know, if they were to look at us and see us blowing each other up, expelling natural resources, why would they want to give us more technology when we're so unstable? It seems almost like we're being nudged to make these decisions for ourselves so that we can be welcomed to this galactic table, if you will.
Maybe that's it. When we finally win the race, then we're welcomed at the table. Hold tight, Jason. Jason Martell is my guest, and we're talking about things past. Very, very past. I'm Art Bell, and this, of course, is Dark Matter on Sirius XM exclusively.
To Art or his guest by pointing your browsing device to artbell.com and jump into the wormhole if you dare.
If you dare. That's right. All right, Jason Martell is my guest, and here is an optimist sending me a message, Jason. John, who says, hey Art, or I guess hey Jason, could the asteroid belt be what's left of Planet X? What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, we're essentially talking about a collision between one of the moons of Nibiru and our primitive Earth, and the intermingling of the waters from, you know, Nibiru and its moon, as well as with Earth. And that's probably where we initially had life being seeded on our planet. The evolutionary process on Nibiru could have been taking place a lot longer. Mm-hmm. So it's very possible that the asteroid belt might actually contain other fragments of life that show a connection between Nibiru and Earth.
Well, I think John was hoping that Planet X is no longer with us, that it is, that all that's left of it now is the asteroid belt.
Right. Well, there was a very excellent researcher, Dr. Thomas Van Flandern, a good friend of mine that unfortunately passed away a little while ago, and he wrote a book called The Exploded Planet Hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, essentially when we look at all of the other planets in our system, even our moon, we see extensive fragmentation from meteorites and comets and various things. So it's very possible that there was, you know, some type of a large, you know, events in the past that caused a lot of these potholes and things that we see not only on our moon, but on some of the other other planets.
Okay. You have mentioned here something about a discovery that was made, something 2,000 years old, some kind of mechanism found in 1901 by divers. What was that?
Yes, that's an excellent piece of technology that was found in, around 1901 off the coast of Antikythera, a small island near Greece there. And it's an interesting device because it's probably about 2,000 years old, and it's more complicated than a modern-day Swiss watch. It has somewhere between 35 and 70 different cogs and wheels all intricately connected. And the Antikythera mechanism was used for two purposes, at least that's what we theorize. One was for as an astronomical device, so that as a person navigating on a ship, they could use this device to tune it to a certain point, to a certain star, as an example, and it would help them navigate the seas. The other purpose of it seemed to be as an astrological device, where it could tell you, like, if you were born on a certain day, that the planet Jupiter aligns with Mars, and you know, then they would be able to give you more information about the zodiacal specificity of your birth date. But a pretty interesting piece of technology that's, you know, over 2,000 years old.
Amazing.
And we really only accredit it to someone like maybe Archimedes, but we really don't know who invented it.
Jason, when scientists, archaeologists find something really old that they cannot explain, they have a way of sort of putting that stuff up on the shelf and just ignoring it because it doesn't fit into the paradigm that they've decided is the way things were.
Yep. We've seen that in many instances of, you know, one of the greatest examples I like through our history is references of the power of flight. We see on various continents depictions of what are mislabeled as bird or insect models that under closer scrutiny, you know, we found one in Egypt in the tomb of an Egyptian governor, and it's labeled as a bird model, but when you look at it, it has all the intrinsic characteristics of a plane and none of the intrinsic characteristics of a bird. Same thing in South America. We found these trinkets, these gold trinkets that look like, for all intents and purposes, little jets, and they have a 90-degree tail fin, and you know, they don't look like a bird. They're mislabeled as insect models, but I think they're actually demonstrations for power of flight.
Mm-hmm. You actually have something called a Sumerian rocket, don't you?
Well, I not myself, but yes, there's an actual term called a shem. And the Sumerian descriptions explain how the gods, the Anunnaki, had these large ships where they somehow, a small piece called the Shem, would detach and come down to Earth. That's how the gods descended to Earth, was on this Shem. And it looks just like a rocket capsule, just like what we would do today in a return capsule coming back to Earth, a little triangular-shaped tip. And it wasn't just the Sumerians. Now, if it was just them, it'd be like, well, that's coincidental. But various other cultures, even in India, the Buddha would be ascending or descending in something called a stupa, which, again, looks like this triangular-shaped kind of a pod. It's a really interesting paradox there, Art, that a lot of the mislabeled pieces of evidence have either been put on a shelf and called something inappropriate, where it's not, you know, it's an insect instead of a plane, or they're just not able to classify what it is.
Jason, if what you say is true, if these cycles come back again and again and again, wouldn't you think that we better get our space program going again quickly?
I do, but for various reasons. You know, I think the threat of us having to leave the planet because of some catastrophe is less likely. I think the idea that, as we were mentioning before the break, there's a galactic community. Mm-hmm. I think I'd be much more interested in being able to interact with beings that are not from Earth. Let me give you an example. I love my pets, and they rely on me for everything. I feed them, I give them, you know, their house, and I give them love. Sure. And they must look at me in such awe. I'm this being that gives them everything, and playing with laptops, and I Skype them, and they're like, how does he talk to me through this thing, right? But they don't
have
understand.
Have any of them yet constructed any tall, pale Jasons?
No, I need to look in the birdcage a little closer, but no, not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But what's interesting, Art, is that this connection that I have with my animals, imagine how they must look at me in awe and reverence. They love me.
Oh, yes.
We as humans supposedly had some connection with something higher than us, where we identified that, wow, we understand our place. There are beings greater than us and expressed to us in ways greater than we can understand. And somehow we lost that. The ancients had it, and now we don't. And I long for that, Art. I think that that might be part of our desensitizing is, you know, there's good and bad. And I personally believe that we would like to reunite with these ancient gods. All these ancient cultures were told by their gods, we are coming back. But that,
Jason,
that's the question.
Do you think that with regard to your pets, that was your something you said up there, your pets love you, as you mentioned. Do you think they love you enough that if you died and you were no longer feeding them, they wouldn't eat you?
They wouldn't eat me.
Yeah, well, in other words, they're the love that they felt for you would keep them from doing that.
I think so. I mean, I wouldn't eat them. I jokingly call my birds, sometimes they smell like little chicken McNuggets, you know what I mean? But I'd never eat them, you know? I mean, I love them. And, you know, we see this in interesting relationships with animals here on Earth where a goat and a mountain lion are friends, or a bear and a dog.
That's
or,
true.
You know, people who have had, like, actual lions as pets, then release them into the wild, come back 4 years later, and the lion runs out of the crowd and tackles the owner, remembering the bond, you know.
Indeed.
Or even, yeah.
No, all of that is true. Nevertheless, I think that if they were starving, Jason, they'd chow down.
Well, you know, it's like, I love them that much, Art, that if I'm dead and they need to feast on me, then hey.
No problem, right?
You know,
okay.
I guess that's how it is.
Well, you know, all of this is really fascinating, and there are so many people that believe this, Jason, and they believe it to the degree that they think it's about to happen again, that the cycle is about to commence.
Well, let's get back on this topic of the cycle, because it's a really close thing to me that it's very esoteric to convey, but I think is immensely important for your audience to grasp, especially people who are interested in the idea of a Nibiru and a Planet X. A couple of breaks ago, we started to talk about that there's three cycles of Earth, astronomical cycles. The first two we're aware of, and the third is a kicker. So the first one is we're spinning on our axis. This simple astronomical cycle of us spinning on our axis causes day and night. Now, we don't think about it, but when it gets dark, you lose consciousness and go to sleep because of an astronomical cycle, meaning that spin of day and night changing affects us. Cycle number two is we're going around the sun. And as we go around the sun, seasons change, winter, spring, summer, fall, animals migrate. You know, there's a lot of things that happen simply because of us going around the sun. Well, there's a third cycle. All the ancients say that there's also another larger cycle, and we track it currently by calling it the precession of the equinox.
Mm-hmm.
And this cycle lasts 24,000 years. Whew, lot larger.
Yeah.
But all the ancient cultures, like the Mayans, had these intricate calendars that we're tracking this large cycle of time. And they very, very clearly said that just like the first two, this third cycle has an effect on humanity. And I think that that cause or the effect is we actually go into the Dark Ages and forget everything and then go into the Golden Age and have this closeness with God. Now, what is causing this third cycle is the new science that I've been really latched onto and studying the last few years. There's an organization, is a business partner of mine, a gentleman named Walter Cruttenden, and he does a conference every year called CPAC. Now, Walter has all of the great people like Dr. Schock, John Anthony West, Robert Bouval, Carmen Bolter, various hard hitters that are looking at this the precession of the equinox model, mm-hmm. and starting to understand that, you know, this is something that has been affecting us for a very long time. There's an interesting analogy, too, so that we can understand and put this into context. You know, 24,000 years is a really long time. There's an insect that lives here on Earth called the mayfly, and it only lives for 24 hours. So if it's born on a cloudy day, another mayfly might come up to it and go, you know, I've heard these rumors of, like, sunshine and wind, but I've never seen it.
That's a good point. It's a very good point.
So it's very possible that we live such a short lifespan that we can't not consider the information being told to us, that there is a larger context and that it has an effect on us.
That really is. It's a very good point. It's a really crushingly good point, Jason.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting, Art. The latest science is saying that we're a binary solar system, two suns, and there seems to be a correlation between our binary orbit, where when our suns are at their closest point to each other, we're in the golden age. When the suns are at their farthest points from each other, we're in the dark ages. And as this cycle repeats, we continue to learn a bunch of information and become very advanced to a point where in the golden age, we can actually, as a whole, some of the Vedic Indian texts explain that these yogis and things that go back tens of thousands of years, they explain that in the golden age, we can actually comprehend God. So we're about 9,000 years away from being in the golden age, but we're just coming out of the Bronze Age. And this cycle, even Plato tracked it. He called it the great year. It's a very interesting way to start to look at our history and understanding that there might be a cyclical pattern to our evolution.
Where does God fit into this, Jason?
Well, you know, God is that's a little bit higher level topic than, you know, I would have any data. But I think
I couldn't resist.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's why.
You mentioned God, and we're talking about these giant cycles, and I'm just wondering where God would fit in. I don't necessarily expect an answer, but...
Well, I have an answer for you, but I think my answer is, again, relying on our current sciences available, as well as a little, you know, slice of faith. I think that the gods and things that are referenced in our current Bible and various texts, you know, most other cultures don't just speak of a god, they speak of gods, even the Hebrew Bible, gods. So I think what we're looking at is all these ancient cultures that we revere now, Egyptians, Mayans, Toltecs, Mesopotamia, they're all speaking of a time when they got to interact with what they considered to be godlike beings.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any of that now, and so we only look at a level higher than what these beings probably were, to the actual one god. There is a wonderful Sumerian tale that explains the Anunnaki's view of God. And the Anunnaki themselves explain to the Sumerians, we believe in a one God, and we call it the father of all creation. And I kind of like that. That's a nice phrase.
I kind of like it, too. Well, we do have the Greys, maybe. What is your view, by the way, on that? Are we being currently visited, in your view?
Yes, I strongly believe that, and when we look at the historical evidence of Greys even being depicted with Sumerians, there's depictions of these beings that they called Ijiji that assisted the Anunnaki in medical experiments and flying their craft, and they pretty much look like a gray alien. You know, if we were created in their image and after their likeness, these, I'm talking about the Sumerians and the Anunnaki, if the Anunnaki did have some genetic intervention with us, and made us in their image and after their likeness, it's very possible they could have taken another Zeta Reticulan or some other type of race and cloned them or done some type of genetic offshoot, because throughout time we have these references of the Watchers or something that is overseeing us.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. So you do believe they're here?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, Art, I feel more inclined to talk about this stuff with you than most hosts. But I don't ever really mention these other things on a lecture, but, you know, because I stick to the ancient stuff. But I've, you know, I'm very intimate as far as friendships with people like Dr. Lear, Steve Neal, Whitley Strieber, not so well, but well enough that we've been through things, and I have been aware of people who have these circumstances in their life, whether it be alien abduction or removing implants or studying this phenomenon firsthand. Without a doubt, there is something happening now, and there has been for a long time. But as I mentioned, it's a little bit more difficult to get into some of these current topics without, you know, there is a
lot. Well, I guess it's reasonable to ask. I mean, do you think that they're monitoring their work?
Sure. That's the angle I kind of take, is that I definitely think that if the Anunnaki from that hypothesis did create us, then why wouldn't they also have, let's call it, a worker race that's helping them with their grand medical experiment? Every time someone's abducted, it has to do with reproductive fluids or genetic information, you know, producing offspring and things that, you know, it's all kind of in alignment with, if they are helping the Anunnaki, that's all they kind of do, is kind of check up on us and relay information, because they don't really show any emotions like the ancient gods did.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jason, what I would like to do is this. I would like to tell my board op back in D.C. to go ahead and open up the phone lines right now.
Great.
We're not going to take calls just yet, but we are going to take calls, and I'll even take Skype calls for Jason Martell. This is all really, truly fascinating stuff, and I'd like an opportunity for you to be able to ask questions. So,
thank you.
We have a phone number. It's a cool one. 855-REAL-UFO or 855-732-5836. And we'll begin taking questions from the audience after the break. Anything else that you really feel is important to get in before we do that?
Well, you know, as we progress in the show, I definitely want to come back to this topic of a binary orbit and explain some of the current research being done by the Binary Research Institute to start to look for evidence that we are actually in a binary orbit.
And with two suns, right?
Correct. Binary meaning two suns.
Right. So should there not very soon now be some technological way to confirm that?
Yes. All of our space satellites, all of our advances in being able to do extrasolar detection, we're putting a lot of focus on the star system Sirius, which is actually Sirius A and B. It's two suns. But it's very likely that there are planets orbiting those suns, and many of these ancient cultures here on Earth, like the Dogons in Africa, no connection to technology, no telescopes, accurately cite that as where the gods are coming from.
Mm-hmm. There was something that I wanted to ask you about. After the continents moved, what evidence is there that all those thousands of years ago there was movement from continent to continent?
Well, as far as trade routes and such, we have two ways to answer that. First, we have ancient maps that some of these go back into the 1400s all the way up into the 1800s, where there's, again, no conveyance of craft like a glider or a hot air balloon, and we have accurate topography of the North and South Pole, which means the landmass is accurately defined underneath a mile thick ice. No ground penetrating radar, no flight craft, but somehow we have these ancient maps that show our land continents correctly underneath a mile thick of ice. How did they get that information? And then there's the idea that, you know, these continents have at some point were connected, because we see animals and species that have been on one continent and moved to another, as well as trade routes and things that over the thousands of years, we didn't think there was any contact, transoceanic contact between these cultures, yet all the evidence is pointing to the fact that, yes, they were all somehow in a large global trade that we weren't aware of until now.
Okay, good enough. I'll hold it right where you are, Jason. Jason Martell is my guest. And when we come back, we are going to take calls. So if you want to be part of it, 855-REAL-UFO. Lots of Planet X talk out there right now. If you have a question, 855-732-5836. We are here. This is Dark Matter.